Good evening. This is Term 5, Session 2 of the Megillas Keheles Shir. We got to Perek Yud, Pasuk Yud, Chapter 10, Verse 10. And it's something that doesn't make sense. If you read it, Poshpira, it does not make sense. So, Im Keha Habarazel, if an axe, or literally, I guess, the iron, but it's translated as an axe, is blunt, Vuhulafonim Kilkal, and one has not spoiled it, or burnished it, or sharpened it, V'chayalim Yagaber, it strengthens the warriors. The Yisroin Hachsher Chachma. But wisdom is a more powerful skill. So this is very obviously encrypted. If an axe is blunt and you haven't sharpened the edge, it strengthens the warriors. Posh pshat, if you can even say there's a simple reason, which there isn't, but if you have a blunt axe, if you go to war with a battle axe, which is blunt, you have to hit the enemy harder. Is that Keheles? It's a bizarre thing to say, out of the blue. But wisdom is a more powerful force. There's a Gemara in Tarnis, Daf Ches Amud Aleph, which darshans this pasuk regarding the concept of Limud Torah. It says the whole pasuk is to do with the learning of Torah. That's the Gemara Tarnis, Daf Ches Amud Aleph, 8a. And we're going to have to resolve the difficulties of this verse. This is a difficult pasuk. Now, we were talking last time about the person who splits logs, referring to Andreinus. And we talked about the previous part, he who moves about stones. Remember that? There was the concept of moving about stones and who's going to hurt them, who's splitting logs. So we're talking about Nebuchadnezzar breaking down a wall, who digs a pit, who's seen slave on horses. This is all coming on the back of this same kind of encrypted idea about talking about specific individuals. So we said that the Romans were the ones who move about stones. Nebuchadnezzar was the one who, Andreinus was the one who split logs. In the previous pasuk, one who digs a pit was Paroi, one who breaks down a wall was Nebuchadnezzar, right? So we're carrying on in that theme of secretly mentioning people throughout Tanakh. Now, we said last time, it's been, granted there's been a bit of a break since we last saw each other, but Pharaoh suffered the fate that he had prepared for others. He wanted to drown the babies in the Nile, and he ended up having his people drowned in the Reed Sea. But what about trying to kill Moshe Rabbeinu? When Moshe Rabbeinu was 17 years old, Paro tried to kill him by executing him with a sword, and miraculously the back of Moshe's neck turned to marble. Not the first time that's happened. Yaakov Avinu had the same experience when Esav tried to kill him by biting his neck. But Moshe Rabbeinu managed to escape at the age of 17 and flee Egypt, and essentially he never came back until he was commanded to by God to become the Mashiach, which he did. So if it says, if an axe is blunt, the Medrash Rabbah on Devarim, Base Chof Vov, that's 2:26, says that when Moshe Rabbeinu was sent by Paro to be executed, the axe became blunt because Moshe's neck miraculously turned to stone. Moshe did not spoil his face and sully the image of God that he had been endowed with, i.e., and one has not spoiled the face or the edge. That's what the pasuk says. Even though a great part of his childhood, 17 years, was spent growing up as a prince in Pharaoh's palace. For anyone that is interested, the pharaoh that is most likely to be the pharaoh of the Tyre, it seems, was Akhenaten II. And his wife was none other than Nefertiti, whose bust you can see in the German Museum of that picture of that that Egyptian woman. That would be Moshe Rabbeinu's adopted mother-in-law, as it were, mother. I mean, Basia was his mother, but that would be his adopted grandmother. That would be Nefertiti was Moshe Rabbeinu's grandmother because she married Akhenaten II. Now, his Kedusha was prevented from becoming sullied to be like one of the Egyptians where he grew up. And you might ask, why weren't the warriors of Israel strengthened in such a manner so they could wipe out Pharaoh once Pharaoh sought Moshe Rabbeinu's life? Avraham was saved by his men, even though Amara fell and a large army were after his blood. If you want, see Bereishis in the 14th chapter. Didn't Moshe Rabbeinu at least deserve being protected from the wicked wiles of Pharaoh? Well, as if a Pharaoh's out to kill him, so you should have a special army to protect Moshe Rabbeinu. But wisdom is a more powerful skill, says Shlomo. Moshe Rabbeinu possessed wisdom, and even though he was unable to conquer Pharaoh at that time, there was a good reason for this. Look at Yud Aleph, number 11. Im Yishach HaNashach B'loi Lachash V'ein Yisroin Leval HaLoshen. The snake bites if it wasn't charmed. And there is no benefit to the tail bearer, literally the owner of a tongue. You could retranslate it as the snake bites if there were no murmurings. Beloy lachash is like murmurings or whisperings. So the Metsudas David says, had it have been charmed, it wouldn't have bitten. So the Metsudas David basically says the charmer shares the moral guilt as he could have prevented the snake's strike, but didn't. That's the Metsudas David. Very, very straightforward application of the words of the verse. But remember, we're talking about Moshe Rabbeinu here. What snake is biting? Says the Al-Shech HaKadosh, and carrying on with the other commentaries that say this is talking about people, the snake that we're talking about was none other than Pharaoh, who had a snake on his crown. He had the image of a snake. So Pharaoh, who is the snake, had not had any good reason to kill Moshe Rabbeinu. You would have thought. But he said, look, at the end of the day, you killed an Egyptian, in which case I've got to kill you. So Pharaoh condemned Moshe to death on account of who? On account of a man called Dosan, out of the Dosan and Aviram fame, who was a talebearer, and he was the one who went to Pharaoh's palace to say, your son, Manaios, which was his Egyptian name, Manaios means drawn from water, and it was translated to Hebrew by God and used as his Hebrew name. But that actually is bizarrely, a phonetic translation to Hebrew from his Goyish name. His parents called him Avigda and Tuvia and So and all these other names. Kodesh Baruch Hu took the Egyptian name and translated it to Hebrew. How interesting, huh? So it was Dosan that went and said, no, Manaios killed him. So that's what it means. There's no benefit to the talebearer, literally the owner of the tongue. That's Dosan. Dosan reported to Paro that Moshe had slayed the Egyptian taskmaster, and that is brought in Shemois Rabbah Aleph Lamed Aleph. That is brought in Shemois Rabbah 131. So Paroi could not be held to blame for his actions. He had to do what the talebearer told him. The snake bites if it was not charmed, then there's no benefit to the talebearer. But if the snake only bites when it gets a tail being born, then it's the guilt of the person who told Paro to act. So really the person who tried to kill Moshe Rabbeinu was Dosan, by grassing him up to the authorities. God did not punish those who made Israel suffer because it was invariably Israel's fault one way or another. Because of their sins, they deserved their fate, and God allowed the system to play out to clear their account or their debt with him so that he could deal with them on a clean slate, which he does not do for the Gentile nations. Anyone that's got any interest in that should see Derech Hashem, section 2, chapter 4, points 5, 6, and 7, where that is talked about at length. So what does it mean there's no benefit to the tale bearer, or the one, the owner of the tongue? So the tale bearer was Dosan, who told the Egyptian authorities that Moshe Rabbeinu had killed the Mitzri who was beating Shlomis Bas Divri's husband. And his sin was so serious that the Israelites suffered greatly at the hands of the Egyptians. We know that Nebuchadnezzar successfully destroyed the temple and devastated the nation of Israel. And again, that was because the people of Israel themselves brought the disaster on their own slate because they were guilty of harboring tzinus chinam, baseless hatred towards one another. While we're here, you might want to ask, how is it possible that the Jewish armies weren't able to overcome Nebuchadnezzar while they were able to overcome the Hellenists at the time of the Hanukkah story? So there's a pasuk in Yeshaya where it says that Klal Yisrael is known as a worm. A worm, it says, a worm, Yaakov, in Yeshaya, Isaiah 41:14. Why? Because essentially all a worm is a body with a mouth at the end. And the whole koyach of a worm is its mouth. Essentially it tills the soil by ingesting and egesting the soil, turning it over, which is very important agriculturally. But essentially worms are mouths, like wiggly mouths. So too, Klal Yisrael are called worm because our main power is in our koyach of tefillah. They have the power in their mouths to destroy their enemies. It's a Yalkut Shmoini on Yeshaya 450 that says that. But prayer does not always help. The verse specifically states that the snake bites them, i.e. their enemies will attack Klal Yisrael, even if there were no murmurings of prayer. The snake bites if there were no murmurings. The snake bites if there was no prayer. But when there is prayer, why does it bite? There's no benefit to the owner of the tongue who prays to counteract the effects of tzinus chinam. See this? Let's read this pasuk again. This is amazing. The snake bites if there were no murmurings, if it wasn't charmed. And there's no benefit to the tale bearer, to the owner of the tongue. The snake, enemies of Israel, Pharaoh et al, will still attack Klal Yisrael if you don't daven, if there's no murmurings. But even if there are murmurings, there's no benefit to the tale bearer, i.e. if there's sinas chinam, even if there is tefillah, I'm going to help you. You got to keep a clean shop and daven in order to have the segula of tefillah. If you want the protectorate of prayer, it comes at good behavior plus effective prayer. Bad behavior, tail bearing, Lashon Hara and grassing up due to the authorities, it's so bad that even with effective prayer, you will still become culpable to attack by your enemies and God will use them to clear your slate. That's the pasuk, basic understanding of the pasuk. Yud Beis, let's go to 10:12. Divrei pi chochem chayim, comma. The words of a wise man win grace or favor. Very interesting now, syntax. Vesifasis, a sfas is a lips. The lips of a ksil, of a fool, they'll destroy him. So listen to this. When it talks about a chochem, it talks about his words. When it talks about a fool, it talks about his lips. Now, the words of someone wise will draw favour upon them, but the lips of a fool will lead to his own doom. What does that mean? The words of the wise find favour with Hashem himself. But the wise man's capabilities are worthless if he's guilty of baseless hatred for his fellow. If he's got this sinas chinam problem that we've just discussed in the previous pasuk, it doesn't matter how wise and how erudite and clean his words are, it'll be useless. He's warning you that prayer requires the prerequisite of a certain behavioural pattern in order for it to remain effective. Any positive effect good, cleverly thought out prayer could have had is negated by Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is more powerful, it seems, than even good prayer. Amazing that, isn't it? Very interesting. Okay. We're now on Yud Gimel. We're on Yud Gimel. Tchilas divrei fihu sichlus. His talk begins as foolishness. For achris pihu hailelus ra'a. And ends as evil madness. Now this is an interesting pasuk. The words that can evoke aid of God could potentially lead to foolishness and ultimately, eventually, to complete insanity. Very difficult way. Now, we've been talking about this perek so far, utilising all the psukim to do with people and what. We've got a whole new way to look at the message that Shlomo's giving us here. Now we said in the second, if you go back all the way back to the second verse, pasuk base, a wise man's heart tends to his right. You could see this as a moshul. They allude to three types of Jews: the wise, the foolish, and the ignorant. Very similar to three out of the four sons mentioned in the Haggadah Shel Pesach. The first is portrayed as a chacham, the wise man. The second, a ksil, a fool, who is not ignorant, but his wickedness causes him to do stupid things. So you call him foolish. But the third is a sechel, he's a simpleton. He's a tom. He's a simpleton. He's a very simple person. And his ignorance leads him to give up Torah and focus his life on meaningless pursuits. Now we said in verse 2 that a wise man's heart leans or tends or is inclined to the right. That is, he strives for knowledge and understanding, while a ksil, a fool's heart, tends to his left. In verse 3, we said, even on the road that an ignoramus walks, etc., such a man doesn't mean to do wrong, but he confuses the meaning of the Torah's words and transgresses without realizing it. I think a prime example, now there's a very shocking example of this with none other than a relatively young Rabbi Akiva. And we discussed this, I think, before. He found a dead body, which we call a mace mitzvah, alone on a road, and there was no one to bury him. So what did he do? He carried it all the way to a base olam, all the way to a cemetery, and then buried the cadaver there. And that, according to the law, was wrong. Because the Talmud Yerushalmi in Nazir Zayin Aleph says very clearly that the halacha is where you find him, that's where you bury him. You don't start dragging him about. You dig a hole right there. Meis Mitzvah is immediately. Dig it. Organize it immediately. Don't start dragging him to a base olam. By making such a mistake, the Gemara pointed out that Rabbi Akiva at that stage was relatively ignorant. His behavior showed him up that he didn't know the law that he should have buried them there and then. Now, the verses after 2 and 3 that we just quoted, and we're going to see the whole pasuk in this new light, can be seen as a hypothetical debate that takes place between these three people, a chacham, a ksil, and which is the wise man, the man who is foolish, and then the simpleton. Then the simpleton. So let's see. This is a new way, again, of seeing the entire perek, but it's all very much on the same vibe that we've been talking about. So if you go back to verse 4, it says, if the anger of a ruler stirred, what were we talking about there? The fool says, if the spirit of the evil inclination, who is the ruler, should rise up and overcome, don't allow it to remain with you, as he'll definitely take complete control over you. You've got to stand firm in your place, or else you're going to find that you're going to give up your portion in Olam Haba. Because the Gemara in Chagiga, Daf Tes Vav, Amud Aleph, says, one who is virtuous merits his own place and the place of another in the Garden of Eden. Who's the other? Someone who wasn't virtuous that gave it up. God dillies out those empty, vacant seats in Gan Eden, and nothing goes to waste. He'll say, right, you can have that one. He gave that one up, so you have more. You can end up taking someone else's Gan Eden. And as Shlomo said, if you remember last time, don't rely on tshuva. If you've lost your place in Gan Eden and you're destined to go to Gehenna, don't just assume that you can repent and have the decree rescinded. Even though tshuva does indeed atone for some sins, it's a remedy which leaves out great offences. That's what the pasuk said, remember? It can only do so much. So tshuva may cause intentional sins to be considered unintentional, but you'll still be held accountable for the unintentional sins. Aye, they were intentional, so they've been downgraded because of tshuva to a much lower intensity, but you still have to pay for those. Better to repent now, says Shlomo, out of love for God, than to repent later out of fear. Definitely good advice in El. And I'm saying this to you, says Shlomo, because I understand that you're a person who essentially wants to depart from their evil ways. So advice is, get atonement immediately. Don't delay. Don't delay tshuva. Because you don't know how many days you got left. Remember in verse 5, there's an evil which I have observed under the sun. It happens so quickly, like an error proceeding from the ruler. Never put anything off. That's what we said. Never delay at today. It only takes a second for the ruler to pronounce a death sentence. You've got to be ever vigilant to be thinking about keeping the cleanest slate you can with as much tshuva as possible. So that's the wise man addressing the fool who feels surmounted by his yetzer hara. And now the wise man is going to turn to the simpleton who doesn't appreciate Torah, isn't interested in striving for it, and has basically checked out of a frum lifestyle. So in verse 6, we said, folly is set on great heights. The pleasures of this world were essentially created for the Gentiles who have no sense of unity as a people. It's a statement of Chazal. Goyim are goyim, they're out for themselves essentially, and they may have a quasi-community and a nationalistic fervour or a sense of patriotism, but they are not truly one people. The people of England are not galvanised like the Jews are amalgamated into one culture. Absolutely not. The Jewish people are one nation that is united as one entity. Indeed, the Zohar Kodesh points out that all Yiddish souls are rooted in one archetypal Jewish soul upstairs. and all the Jewish soldiers split off from there. So Jewish people are actually rooted to one global spiritual root. Now, if you want, this is unbelievable. This is unbelievable. It's a worth coming moment. I don't have many of them, but I'm telling you, you're going to love it. This knocks it out the park. Honestly, it is worth coming for this moment. I've got to read something to you. Let's go to Bereshit. And I'm in Parshas Vayishlach, and I'm in the 36th Perek, okay? And this is the Chronicles of Esav, where Esav separates himself from Yaakov, and he walks away, and he said, you know, I'm going to go make up my own place like that. If you read 36:6, very interesting what's going on here. Give me a second. V'yikach Esav es noshov. And Esav took his wives, v'es bonov, and his children, v'es benoisov, that his sons and his daughters, v'es kol nefashos beisoi, and all the souls of his house, his entire household, whoever they were, that's what he took, right? Interesting. Okay, that makes sense. Hold hard here. We're now going to contrast that to Bereshit Mem Vov 46 Chof Zayin 27, which is in Parshas Vayigash, which gives the list of the 70 souls that descended into Egypt with Yecheved born at the border. Yeah? Let's look at 27. Uvnei Yosef Asher Yulad Loiva Mitzrayim, and Yosef's sons who were born to him in Egypt numbered Nefesh Shnaim, soul singular, Shnaim, two. Kol HaNefesh, all the soul, Leves Yaakov Haba Mitzrayim Shivim, all the soul that entered Egypt was 70. That's bad syntax. That's bad grammar. Go back to Parshas Vayishlach. It said over there, it says, V'es kol nefashos beisoi of Esav, all the souls of his house. That's perfect sentence, lots of people. So you call them souls. What does it say? Nefashos. See it in Genesis 36:6. Souls, nefashos. Go to Genesis 46:27. All the soul, singular, nefesh, that went down to Egypt was 70. Why, when it talks about Yaakov's genealogy, does it mention soul in the singular when we're talking about 70 people? And it lists those 70. Leah, Zilpah, Bilhah, and all their children. That's Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zavul, and Dinah, Yosef and Benyamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad and Asher, and all their children. That number's 70. And it talks about the nefesh. Answer, Yiddish souls are from one nefesh. Not so the Gentiles. Gentile souls are created from separate accounts. In which case, the unity that Klal Yisrael has is simply unobtainable in the world of nefashos, in the world of multiplicity of souls. But Klal Yisrael has a nefesh. All 13 million Jews, one nefesh. Upstairs. In the Torah, black and white, nefashos, nefesh. Now, that was a worth coming moment. You got that down there, you can prove it. That's how the Torah relates to the Bnei Yaakov as the Bnei Esav. Very interesting idea. Now, we see that Yaakov and his brother took one part of this world each. Esav took the material Gashmi Chitzaini external elements, while Yaakov took the Panimi, the internal spiritual elements within the world, to utilize the world as a tool for spirituality. So the wisdom of Torah was certainly given to Yaakov's people so they could establish a close relationship with Hashem, utilizing the Panimi, the internality, the spiritual element of the world for this particular point. Esav said, I don't want that. I'm after the outside stuff. So that the wisdom of the Torah, it would be incorrectly, it would be bad than the Torah. They would only misuse it. They're not, they don't want what it's got to offer. When he said in verse 6, folly, that was the worthlessness of material pleasures that we discussed, is set on great heights. Folly is set on great heights. That's how he started verse 6. I.e., it was given to those in high places. And that is an allusion to the Gentiles who were associated in the plural form, high places, like the plural of nefashos, which seems correct. Souls are plural. Nefashos is many souls. Because they're not one people, but they're rather viewed by the Torah as a collection of many peoples together in a nation. They're a blend. It says the rich sit in low places. We discussed that and what that meant in a very different way to what I'm going to say now. The Jewish people must suffer deprivation in order to gain admittance to their world. So we said it very differently as when we said the rich sit in low places. The rich should sit in a low place in this world to keep their bracha. That's what we said. That was basic advice. But I was saying the rich, those who have got the Torah, that's the Jewish people, unfortunately must suffer deprivation by sitting in low places so they can clean their slate so they can get to Olam Haba properly. So the wise man here is saying to the Tom, the simpleton, why do you insist on rejecting Torah? What are you going to get from it? Where's it going to get you? The fool, who's the Russia, retorts back to the wise person who's giving. Remember, Shlomo's teaching this to you as an emotional. He's always doing that. He's trying to give over a debate, like a shaklavataria, a question answer, to teach you a moral lesson in KLS. So if you see verse 7, which we already saw, I saw slaves walking barefoot. How do we understand it in this light? There's a Gemara in Kiddushin, Daf Lamed Tes Amud Beis, 39b. It says, what does one see before he leaves the ways of Torah and goes on an evil path in life? What is going to tempt you away? Some say he sees a man who asks his son to bring him some fledglings. That's the Gemara. So he says, go get me those little birdies. So the son dutifully climbs the tree and shoos away the mother bird, for if it is indeed an ownerless tree, then that would be fulfilling the mitzvah of Shluch HaKan, of sending away the mother bird. And the mother bird flies away and he takes the young ones, because his father, under Aus Kibud Av Va'Aim, under the mitzvah of honoring his father, which is a very big mitzvah, and notice Shluch HaKan and honoring of the father are both rewarded with lengthening of days. The only places where the Torah explicitly spells out the reward for these two disparate mitzvahs. And as he's doing that, he falls off the tree with the fledglings in his hand, crashes down to the ground, breaks his neck and dies. What? But he's doing the two mitzvahs in the Torah that give lengthening of days. And what about the segula of doing a mitzvah? He's doing two of them. And they're both deraisa. They're both scripture. The one who sees such a sight, which is such an open travesty of the Torah's promises, will break down in a crisis of faith and will say, that's it. I'm off. Throw my kippah in the bin and go lead a wicked lifestyle. I'll lead a successful life while those righteous people doing their mitzvahs suffer. Doesn't get them anything anyway. and he's going to draw a very false conclusion, turn away from the tyrant, and lead a free, emancipated, enlightened lifestyle. Well, what such a person replies to the wise man is, I've seen slaves on horses and nobles walking on foot like slaves. He's viewing the world as a collection of contradictions for which he has no answers. How come righteous people suffer? What about the Holocaust? Based upon those open contradictions, clearly there's no point to Torah and mitzvahs. Dump it. It's not useful. Verse 8, he who digs a pit, will he not fall into it? One who removes stones from his neighbor's garden and takes them to his own yard, will he not be hurt by them? We said that was the Romans, but we're using this as a drush now as the argument. Why does he live long? He who cuts down trees of his neighbor and takes them for himself, should he not be endangered by them? When he sees all these things, he says, where is God the most just? I don't see him. What about that kid that fell off the tree doing Shiluach HaKan and fulfilling the mitzvah of Kibbutz Av? Pah! There's your, it doesn't work. It doesn't work! I'm off down the pub. That's the Rosh's response to the wise man. The simpleton, who was just told about this concept of nefesh and nefashos, and it's not worth giving up everything to go into a world of materialism, he turns around and quotes the verse that we started off with today. If the axe is blunt, I can counter your arguments like this. I know I'm not wise, but I'm actually happy about it. I'm actually overjoyed I'm not a chacham. Why? Because if the axe is blunt and it doesn't cut well, i.e. if I'm unwise and I don't cut well in my wisdom, you can't blame me. It's because I don't have a burnished edge. Right? In its sharpened state, the warriors are strengthened because good swords and good weapons aid their soldiers, right? But wisdom is a more powerful skill. Using a sharp weapon rather than a blunt one is like performing a task with common sense and understanding rather than doing a job just stump. If you do it sharp with common sense and understanding, you're far more likely to carry out that task better. Without wisdom, a person doesn't know how to serve God in the correct manner. He's like a blunt axe that doesn't cut. I too, says the simpleton, cannot be held to blame for my ignorance because I was never in a position to be sharpened. I was never in a position to know better. And you can't hold me guilty for not doing mitzvahs correctly. Nobody taught me. That's the argument of the, another argument if the axe is blunt. Verse 11, which we've done regarding the snake charming and Pharaoh and Dothan and Moshe. The snake bites. That can also be understood as the Yetzer Hara hits you. You get struck by the Yetzer Hara. And the Yetzer Hara particularly likes knowledgeable people because he's after bigger stakes. He's got very big fish to fry, the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara particularly delights in trapping those who are particularly well-versed in Torah. Oh, that's a win. Chopping this simpleton fool is no great shake. I mean, he's an idiot. But chopping the chochem, wow, that's brownie points. There is no benefit to the owner of the tongue. That refers to the snake that enticed Adam and Isha to eat from the Eitz Hadas Tovara. Pirkei Derebi Eliezer, chapter 13, says this was actually an archangel whose name we don't pronounce, which is an evil angel, who appeared on earth in the form of this reptilian. And he is known as the owner of the tongue because he was the one animating this creature to try to get Adam, who was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, to sin. Indeed, Alpi Kabbalah, according to our Kabbalistic traditions, Adam Arishan, prior to the sin, was in a state of constant Ruach HaKodesh, a state of constant prophetic revelation. He was literally in prophecy the entire time until he ate of the eight stars of Tevurah. And within that prophetic revelation, within that prophetic experience, as he was walking about in this area, the Nachash came up to her and tried to convince her to convince him to have some of it. It's a very famous Gemara in Sukkah, Daf Nun Base Ahmed Aleph, 52a, that the greater a person, the greater his Yetzer Hara. Why? It's got to balance out his big Yetzer Tov. If you've got a very strong draw to good, you have to have a very strong draw to evil to keep things balanced. Now you might say, well, then I just won't have a good, you know, I'll just keep lowly and then I have a lowly. Yeah, but you get much more reward. If you, it's like a high roller. Why play poker for 10 pence when you can play for 10 million? Because I could lose 10 million. Yeah, but high rollers don't want to be poor. Yeah, when you're sitting at those high tables, which do happen, you know, the stake's incredible. So the simpleton will say, since I'm ignorant, my Yetzer Hara is also much weaker. So it's better for me to stay ignorant and not become wise so that I'm not so pestered by my Yetzer Hara. It's a strategy for success in life. I'll stay stupid. And then the Yetzer Hara will be a stupid Yetzer Hara. He doesn't want small fry like me. And I won't be enticed to sin or transgress because I'll have a weakling Yetzer Hara and he won't really nudge me that much. Which, of course, is an incredibly foolish attitude, because relatively you're going to be as bothered, irrelevant as who you are. It's always 50-50 kind of thing, you know what I mean? But he just, this is his excuse. Ah, you know, I have a little nudgy Yetzer, it's nothing major. There's an alternative reading. A serpent will naturally bite even if it's not charmed. But if it is charmed, it may not bite. What does this mean? The Yetzer Hara is no better than a regular snake. There is no benefit to Lashon Hara. But this archangel who appeared in the form of the Nachash used his tongue to entice Adam and Isha. Her name was Isha at that point, literally from man. That's woman. It wasn't, her name wasn't changed to Chava or Eve until after the sin and the judgment of it. To sin. So so this Yetzer Hara came up to tempt them. But a real snake doesn't have a tongue and cannot talk. Doesn't have a human tongue. Evil has power only in its tongue. And that power can be used to dominate one even who is wise. The fool will say it won't dominate an ignoramus like me, and therefore it is actually an advantage to actively remain ignorant. So after hearing all these arguments from the fool and the simpleton says it's good to be a simpleton, and the fool says, what are you going to get from all this? Ah, there's people, you know, who keep Torah and they die young. What a waste of time. He falls off a tree doing mitzvahs. Psst. Doesn't make sense, does it? In his advice, in verse 12, which is where we got to, he said, the words of the wise man give chayin. The words of the wise give grace, while the lips of fools will lead to doom. A fool denies the truth of divine providence and lives as a free thinker. As it says in verse 13, his talk begins as foolishness. In other words, he's got the fool's claim that he sees slaves riding on horses. The world is topsy-turvy and there's no justice in it. That's foolishness. And it ends as madness. His second argument of when we said in verse 8, if you remember, he who digs a pit will fall into it, right? That was, we talked about Paro there. He dug a pit utilizing water and he fell into it at Yamsuf. That's also likewise madness. Because as we said, I know that whatever God does, that men should fear him. And if the sentence of evil work is executed speedily, as we said in 8:11, no one would fear him. If God hit everyone the second they did an Aveira, there'd be no Bechira. We said that already. Imagine going out for a burger at McDonald's. As soon as it touches your lips, a bolt of lightning comes out and leaves you as a smoking pair of boots. I got news for you. If that happens 2, 3, 4, 5 times, no Jew would go to McDonald's. Just out of sheer physical, it's medically bad for you. They'd have no fear of God, but only of punitive measures. Real fear of God is not getting punished directly when you do a sin, and fearing him and not doing it anyway. That proves allegiance. I'm doing it because I fear God. I know this is not what God wants me to do, so I'm not going to do it. Irrelevant of whether they're going to punish now or not. But if I'm only going to do it because I know I'm going to get punished now, therefore I'll avoid that behaviour, then you're not fearing God, you're just avoiding lightning bolts. You fear lightning. So you don't stand on the trees in the wet. It's not God that I'm fearing, it's just... Look at your dalad. V'asachol yarbe devarim. And ignoramus speaks much. Got a lot of words. Lo yeda ha'adam ma'ashi yeh v'ashi yeh ma'achrav. Mi yagid loy. Yet man does not know what shall be, and that which shall be after him. Who can tell him? If the fool, the ignoramus, speaks without realizing what he's saying, because he doesn't know what's coming up. He assumed that if he could just remain ignorant, he won't be condemned by the heavenly court, because they'll say, well, he's an idiot. He's under the mistaken impression that the Yetzer Hara simply won't influence him because he's such a scrawny Yetzer Tov, he's going to have a scrawny Yetzer Hara, therefore he'll never be led to sin and he'll die at Tzaddik. That's not a clever way round it. Even if we knew what punishment awaited us after death, it would be of little use. For who can tell him? Because no one's going to believe him anyway. If you actually said to someone, look, this is what's going to happen, and he's going to go, I don't believe you. Amal aksilim tiagen asher lo yod leches el ir. The toil of the fool will weary him like one who does not know the way to town. It's important. We've got to understand what town is here. The town, according to Chazal, is the heavens. The way to town is the way back upstairs. That's the home of the Melochim. You want a proof for that? It's in Mishlei, same author, Proverbs 21:22. The wise man scales the town of the mighty. And over there it is very clear that we're talking about the Melochim and their abode. The foolish man who is ignorant assumes he won't be judged for his misdeeds. I was foolish. I didn't know anything. It's an extenuating circumstance. I'm ignorant. And I've got a very small Yetzer Hara because I've got a very small Yetzer Tov. They'll just let it slide. Now this is really intense. This is pretty scary. It's pretty scary. Little does he realize that when he dies, his soul will be sent into the hollow of a sling. Now, this is taken from Shmuel Aleph, Samuel 1, 25-29. This is pretty scary. I don't want to end on this note, so I'll try to do this in a bit more. This is pretty scary. Just, I'm warning you. If you look at the Medrash Rabbah on Keheles, 3:21, and you see Sharei Tshuva by Rabbeinu Yonah, 2:18, and the Michtav Me'Eliyahu, Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler's work, Strive for Truth, Volume 2, page 63. They all talk about this concept in Shmuel 1, 25-29, the hollow of a sling. The soul of certain wicked people finds no rest even before it reaches Gehenna. because of evil deeds, impurities came into existence which produced negative angels. That's a Mishnah in Avos, a Mishnah in Ethics of the Fathers. One good deed, one defender. One Avera, one prosecutor. These are angelic prosecutors you create, which is why the judgment's so perfect. It's actually the outcome of your deeds which either accuse or defend you. And they look like you. The Melochim Yaakov sent over to Esav were his Melochim in his image. The Melochim you make are in your image, either for good or bad. After a person dies, these Melochim push and throw his soul about. They knock him about as if it were a stone in a sling. And these souls are deeply attached to the material values of Olam Hazeh, and they need much purification before they can proceed upstairs to Shemayim. The toil of the fool will weary him like one who does not know the way to town. That soul will get knocked about because he won't know the way to town because he's too busy getting beaten up by his own Melochim that he created with his stupidity and his sins. These evil forces that have been created through his sins are called Ksilim, fools, because they came about as a direct result of foolishness. So they take on that middah. Even though this man was ignorant, his sins are considered transgressions committed with intent, because he could have got himself out the ignorance, but didn't, because he made it a life philosophy to remain non-educated. Fine, then it's on you. Amazing. There is a whole discussion in Parshas Vayechi in the Zohar as to the near-death experience. What happens near death? This concept of seeing a light and going through a tunnel is actually brought in the Zohar and Parshas Vayechi. And when the soul leaves this world, it perceives a light at the end of a tunnel, which is very much how we enter this world, seeing a light at the end of a tunnel. Except the light at the end of a tunnel in this world is painful to the eyes of a baby, but the light at the end of the tunnel for the soul that's leaving this world isn't painful because it's not a physical light. It doesn't hurt the eyes. Now, when such a soul, a foolish soul, leaves the world, it sees the divine presence and it's drawn to it. It's drawn to this light, which is what causes the death process below. Now, usually what would happen is that light would take that soul to town. It would take it to the next stage. But for such an ignoramus who's branded as a fool and did wanton sins with intent, then that light, as it were, draws away and it can't hold on to it. And that soul, as it were, is just dropped without that guiding light. It doesn't know the way to town. And it is now at the mercy of those negative forces it itself created, chucking about like a stone in the hollow of a sling, says Shmuel. That's what Shmuel was talking about. He says, don't be one of those guys. This is what happens immediately after death. And then, when it finally does find its way to the soul world, it's only got Gehenna to look forward to. It's really... So having this stupid view to say, I'd rather remain ignorant. Don't teach me, Tyra. I'd rather not know, because at least then I don't have to be culpable for not keeping it, leads to this unimaginably unpleasant outcome. Solomon and Kehelis. It's El Tyra, no? That's pretty scary, El Tyra. Do tshuva. Test sign. 16. Ilach Eretz, Shmal Keich Na'ar, For Sarech, a biker yikl. Woe to you, O land, whose king acts as a youth and whose ministers dine in the morning. What's this got to do, my Inyan Schmidt? Why are you saying this? Stam, are we learning about political systems, about how countries should be? Next pasuk. Ashreich Eretz Shemalkeich Ben Chayrim. Happy are you, O land, whose king is a free man. V'sarech ba'eis yachlu gvura v'loy v'ashti. And whose ministers dine at the proper time, in strength, and not in preparation for war. Wow, that was a bit another left of field pasuk, it seems, from Shlomo. What has this got to? All the four Shema I've seen, especially the Alshech, there is absolutely no contextual link between what these psukim seem to be saying and anything we've learned in the whole parak. Just stunned. I just want to tell a guy who'd be reading this, wants to do Bible criticism, would probably quite rightly conclude that Keheles, which is what Bible critics or revisionists, as they like to call themselves, have concluded by saying that Keheles, Ecclesiastes, wasn't written by Solomon, but probably a bunch of monks, they actually attribute it to Christians, which is obviously nonsense, but they attribute it to Christians over a period of hundreds of years. Because if you read them, the Pesukim don't seem to make any sense. It must be that one man wrote this, one man wrote that, one man wrote this, one man wrote that. Because they have no Torah Baal Peh. They have no idea what the Torah is really saying. If you are coming at the Torah without Torah Baal Peh, you're right to conclude Keheles was probably written by multiple people. Doesn't make any sense. It must be this was put in later or badly edited. Indeed, the Mefushim say, if you look at it like that, doesn't matter. Woe to you, lads, what are you talking about? It's like a completely new parak. It's like, you know, we're starting a new idea. No. No. But actually, these are all ideas that we've previously expressed. We're going to have to understand this. There's only three psukim left to this parak. And there's only 12 prokim. So we're almost finishing parak Yud here. We're almost finishing the 10th chapter. Which is, you know, really, what we've got to understand is the concept of the king is always, in this case, in this argument, is the Yetzer Hara. A king who acts as a youth. What does that mean? That's bad. Versus a king, a Yetzer Hara, who's a free man and whose minister's done at the proper time. We've got to understand what this means. We're talking about an individual in his own internal battle with the Yetzer Hara and what he can do to overcome it and maintain his tzidkus. So these two psukim are one idea. And the next three psukim are essentially all corollaries of it. And that finishes off the 10th parak. And that's where we've got to tonight. I really appreciate your time. Thank you very much for being here. And I hope, Ezra Shem, to finish off this parak with you next time, which is only three psukim, and then start the 11th parak and go through the themes of the 11th parak, and then cut into Yud Aleph Aleph, where it says, Shalach Lachma, cast your bread upon the waters, for you'll find it after many days. That's actually talking about tzedakah, the concept of charity. Obviously, cast forth your bread now, you'll find it after many days in Olam Haba. Or the only money you keep is the money you gave to tzedakah. That's yours. Everything else, the account's going to be closed. Or it'll be taken by your inheritors. It's not yours. The money that's yours is that which you used for mitzvahs. And it's tzedakah being one of the ultimate mitzvahs you can do with money. But any mitzvah money, really. But that's what it means, cast your bread upon you. Why is tzedakah chasing on the heels of Yetzer Hara? That's what we're going to discuss. And very Elul themes as well. And please God, I look forward to continuing with you next week. If you have any questions, now will be the time. Otherwise, I look forward to seeing you then.